take just a minute to introduce Jim Heffley. He and I were neighbors for a few years. He lived on the top of one mountain on one side of Chattanooga, and I live on a mountain on the other side of Chattanooga. But 2 years ago, he moved to an area where he could fulfill, I guess, the dream of every country boy of America, to Hannibal, Missouri, where he heads up the Mark Twain Writing Institute and does some teaching down there. And I can envision Jim with a straw hat on his head and barefoot with rolled up jeans paddling a raft out on the middle of the Mississippi River. But Jim has also fulfilled the dreams of a lot of us. In fact, John Knapp has as well. He's a published author with how many books, Jim?
Oh, 40 or so.
That's what I saw. And who knows how many other articles. So he has been a very prolific writer, and of course, we have all seen his writings at one point or another. He has also gotten a doctorate in mass communication, and on that basis, he's been specializing in the whole area of mass media. So with that kind of a background, it's good news that Jim Heffley is going to talk to us about good news, bad news, and mixed news.
Thank you, Russ. I really have a book out called Way Back in the Hills that has a little boy with a straw hat on the cover, and it's about growing up in Arkansas. And I have received more mail on that little book than all of the other books combined. And the typical writer is a man about my age, or Russ's age, who is writing in the middle of the night after he spent hours reading back about the childhood and being able to identify with this, and writing in a sense of nostalgia. And I've had men to write and say they were crying when they read the book. And it isn't a soapy, sentimental book, but that hasn't happened, nothing to do here. But anyway, I'm going to get into this. This is supposed to be about communications. I have a little story about a lady who came to a lawyer for a divorce. And he asked her, he said, "Do you have grounds?" And she said, "Yes, sir." She said, "An acre and a half." So he decided to try it again. He said, "Well, do you have a grudge against your husband?" He said, she said, "No, sir, we have a double carport." She said, "Well, lady, let me get more to the point. Does your husband beat you up in the morning?" She said, "No, generally I get up before he does." And he said, "Now, are you sure you really want a divorce?" She said, "No, I don't want a divorce. It's my husband." He says, "We have trouble communicating." I hope that I can communicate here tonight on this subject of bad news, good news, and mixed news. This is really a part of a doctoral dissertation on a controlled field experiment in Alaska. And what I'm going to do is set my watch right here before you and cover the high points and try to at least get through and stop 20 minutes afterwards, because I think this particular subject lends itself to discussion, because all of us in some way or another are in the business of communicating, whether we write, whether we speak, whether we teach, or whatever we do. How many times have you put down the evening newspaper or switched off the evening news with the feeling of being encircled in a cloud of gloom? You know what I mean? A whole litany of bad news, civil war in South Africa, the Marxists taking over, the U.S. defeated in the U.N., another car bomb explosion in Beirut, and you've seen it all in living color right in your living room, or maybe while you were eating dinner with the television sitting on the table across. A local judge indicted for accepting payoffs, teachers threatening to strike, no cure on the horizon for AIDS, a horrendous car crash, ad nauseum, ad infinitum. And maybe you groaned, "Can't they find anything good to report today?" Well, generally, if you watch the media, you find that they cannot find too much good to report today, although the TV evening news often come in with a little story that at least will make you grin or laugh just a little bit. Well, if you think that our print and broadcast news media lean to the negative, you're right. The research has been done by my mentor, and if you're interested in exploring this further, the person to consult or look at some of his research is Jack Haskins, who is a professor of communications research at the University of Tennessee. Jack and other people have done all kinds of studies that in effect show two things. Our news media, that is extremely bad news oriented. In fact, one study showed that American television is twice as bad news oriented as Canadian television. That not only includes television, but newspapers, radio. There's kind of a hierarchy there. Local radio stations are the worst. They're the worst. Now, there's also evidence that suggests that bad news has bad effects upon audiences. For example, one study showed that a follow-up of a bad news broadcast, that not only did listeners of the broadcast feel more depressed, they were also less likely to aid a person needing help. There are many, many other studies in that area. Now, interestingly enough, maybe it shouldn't be interestingly enough, the media perceives that bad news gets attention. And so we live in a bad news world. In fact, according to Dr. Haskins, our entire journalistic system is built upon the concept that bad news sells. And so there is an emphasis, a concentration on bad news. Hannibal, Missouri, where I live, the year of the sesquicentennial, had an enormous amount of publicity, but much of it was bad news. They hoped to get publicity on the sesquicentennial for the sesquicentennial celebration of Mark Twain's birth, but the mayor was practically impeached. I mean, just trouble all throughout. And that brought in a lot more media. For example, at the Southern Baptist Convention last year, there were over 600 media covering a denominational convention. All the major networks were there. Now, I doubt if there would have been over 125 if there had not been a conflict. In other words, there had not been perceived a bad news situation. Now, the studies show also that we are fascinated by and seek out unpleasant experiences involving other people. Morbid curiosity, one professor at the University of Georgia calls it. And he has written a paper, sort of a socio-biological takeoff, on trying to show, in effect, why is it that we are drawn to the morbid or to bad news. We are fascinated by and seek out unpleasant experiences involving other people. This seeming paradox may point to what Rollo May called the human dilemma revealed in man's capacity for admirable rational nobility on the one hand and irrational behavior on the other. For the biblical theologian or student, it illustrates, or at least to me, the continuing conflict in man's inner being between the moral rationality of the implanted image of God and the immoral irrationality resulting from the fall. Now, there have been calls for good news in the media. In March 1983, President Reagan said, at least in his prepared speech, that he said, "I know good news isn't good for the ratings. I only wish Dan Rather, Brokaw, and Ted Koppel and others would focus a bit more on some of the truly admirable things being done by the American people." The text drew network criticism even before he mounted the podium. And so he curtailed his remarks to simply say that, quote, "maybe television should focus on good news for a week," close quote. The networks, of course, didn't buy it. But back in 1900, the Reverend Charles Sheldon, the author of the best-selling novel In His Steps, persuaded the Topeka Daily Capital newspaper to give him control of the newspaper for a week. And so he ran it on his concept of news as, quote, "anything in the way of current events that the public ought to know for its moral and spiritual development." He eliminated ads of corsets, patent medicines, and alcoholic beverages. On the front page, he ran a prayer, a sermon against militarism, a plea for aid to famine sufferers in India, and expounded on a law proposed to outlaw alcohol. He instructed reporters, quote, "in dealing with crime, make little more than a bare announcement. Leave out all horrible details. Give the cause of the crime." It got national coverage. The circulation of the newspaper jumped to 360,000, with extra editions printed in Chicago and New York. But in Topeka, the demand also skyrocketed for other papers which printed more customary types of news. He was lambasted. And after a week, the paper resumed business as usual. St. Petersburg, Florida, some years ago, the Evening Independent ran a daily column for more than 5 years called Good News Tonight on the front page. But in a letter to me, editor Robert Stiff said his staff came to dislike it so much that the quality of the column greatly deteriorated until I raised the white flag and surrendered. Reader interest wasn't sufficient to warrant continuance. He also, and I mentioned, turned the whole front page, not only a column, but for a while, he turned the whole front page into a complete good news page. Now, Dr. Haskins and others, they have asked, cannot bad news be handled better? Granted, bad news is realistic. We live in a bad news world. So Dr. Haskins tested readers on straight news treatment versus constructive treatment of two negative topics. Basically, he took a straight bad news story and just basically told the bad news. The second story, he worked in a kind of a cloud with a silver lining. he left the reader with some hope. He found out that bad news with hope, or mixed news, was significantly more interesting than just plain bad news. Another study found similar results. And so when I came along as a graduate student with Dr. Haskins, he had felt that bad news could be handled more constructively by the cloud with a silver lining approach, and thus my study, a controlled field experiment in Anchorage, Alaska. Now, I made some assumptions here. One is that mass media messages can attract attention and interest among a targeted audience. Number two, messages will have certain causal effects on receivers. Three, these effects can be measured to show causality. Fourth, the measurable facts will vary among persons depending on certain variables operable during the test. Fifth, positive, negative, and mixed messages will show different effects. Now, rather than read this, I think I will just try to explain what we did. I accepted a job as a communications consultant for the largest Baptist church in Alaska. They had an evangelist named Anish Sharosh, who is a Palestinian from Nazareth, a very outstanding Arab preacher, coming for a week's revival crusade starting on Sunday. We had an enormous amount of publicity. They paid my way up there and paid me for the week's work, paid me for another week's work, and then part of the deal was that I would be able to use the church membership as guinea pigs without them knowing it, with only the staff knowing it. So what we did was we set up a special Saturday evening meeting in which Dr. Sharosh would give a report on the Middle East. He had just returned from the Middle East before this. Now, no one knew this except the targeted audience. We broke down in a systematic sample four groups of 529 people, the active members of this church. And one group, we called them the bad news group, one group the good news group, one group the mixed news group, and the other group, of course, was the control. Now, all four groups got a ticket, a different colored ticket. The control group only got a ticket 2 days before the special Saturday evening meeting, which was unannounced, a ticket to this special meeting, just the bare announcement of it, and that was all. The other groups each got a letter, but the letters were designed and written by me and signed by the evangelist. They were especially designed. Now, for example, in each letter, the evangelist introduced himself and announced that he had just returned from the Middle East and would give a special report on Saturday evening to a select group of special guests at the church. Everybody knew, you see, the special services were going to start on Sunday. There'd been no advertisement of this. There's no other way, really, so far as we knew, for them to know. Now, after introducing it, the letters diverged, and here's how they diverged. The negative letter began after the introduction, quote, "Iran is now in great turmoil and may fall to the communists. Since President Sadat's tragic murder, some fear that Egypt will be taken over by radicals." On and on we went for several more paragraphs of all of the dire things that could happen. And indeed, all of this was true. I mean, people were projecting this. Now, the positive or the good news letter began, quote, "The peace program between Israel continues to go forward. Israel is preparing to return the captured Sinai to Egypt. The new Egyptian leader, the president, is carrying out the dream of President Carter." And on we went for an equal number of paragraphs with nothing but good news. Now, the mixed letter after the introduction went something like this. "Iran is now in great turmoil, but the communists have not taken over, as some have been predicting. President Sadat is dead, but his successor is carrying on his peace program." And it went on like this, with a statement of bad news and a statement of hope. Bad news, hope, bad news, hope, bad news, hope. Each letter then closed with an invitation to come to this special meeting and hear more. Now, what I'm going to do here, for the sake of time, I am going to skip all the way to the discussion or the findings, what we found out, basically, from this, the results. 79 people came and 16 guests. Each received a ticket which would admit them and admit guests. Our first two measures came at the door. When we checked to see which group brought the largest proportion, you know, of the numbers, you know, receiving the message, my hypothesis was that the mixed message would bring more people to hear more information. Now, I had done some pretesting by some Baptist church groups in Tennessee, and generally they had said that the bad news would bring more people out. But I felt, considering Jack Haskins' research, that the mixed news would do better. Well, as far as the people coming, the information was not confirmed statistically. There just wasn't enough difference there to say that any of the letters made a difference. But the positive message did lead, and the negative was down at the bottom. The differences were just not statistically significant. Now, the second measure there was on the number of guests. And again, I had hypothesized that the recipients of the mixed message would be more likely to bring guests. I was wrong. That was rejected by a highly significant percentage. The positive, good news message brought more guests. The control came second, the mixed message third, and the negative message fourth. Now, when they came in, we took their different colored tickets. They were given a sealed paper that was the same color as the tickets, and they were instructed not to open this paper until the end of the preacher's message, until he gave his report. Now, I had not coached him on his report. I said, just tell your report realistically the way it is. Well, what he did, you know, if you're realistically, you give a mixed message. There's bad news and there's good news. The fellow said when came and his friend said, I got some bad news for you and some good news. He said, tell me the good news first. He said, your mother-in-law that you hate just went over the cliff. He said, what's the bad news? Said she was driving your Cadillac. Well, we have all kinds of stories like that. But we went in and he gave basically a mixed news type of thing. So in this respect, you see, the control group now was exposed to some content about the Middle East for the first time. And they basically, at least in my judgment, became a kind of a mixed group, became a part of the mixed group. Now, we had various measures. At the end of his message, we asked them to open up the papers and check various commitments. All right, we wanted to know, would it make a difference in commitments? For we've already had the attendance check. The only thing we knew statistically to that point was that the good news people, they brought twice more people than all of the other groups combined. The bad news people, I think they brought one at the most, the whole group. Okay, I had hypothesized that attenders from the mixed message group would be more likely to commit themselves to attend further meetings at which the source would speak. This was rejected with significant differences. Attendance from the control group led, with mixed messages, participants second, positive people third, the negative group last. Indeed, on all of these commitments, and I'll mention some of the others in just a moment, the bad news was at the bottom. Now, you can explain, I'm getting a little ahead of the discussion here, but I think you can explain this control group, because basically that was the one that did better on the commitment, possibly in two ways. One of them is the people who got just a ticket without a letter may have come just because they were loyal to the church. They are the type of people to turn up, and they are the type of people to make commitments. But on the other hand, there's another possibility that the control group came in there, and they heard a mixed news message, and they were more, by hearing that mixed news message, they were more likely to respond and to make a commitment. I had hypothesized that attenders from the mixed message group would be more likely to commit themselves to attend further meetings. This was rejected with significant differences. But the control group led, and the mixed message group came in second. Again, the positive was third and the negative was last. Then I had hypothesized that the recipients of the negative message would be more likely to make a commitment to pray daily for the upcoming meeting. This was not confirmed. The differences were not significant. I had hypothesized that mixed message receivers would be more likely to commit themselves to invite friends to the revival. This was confirmed with high significance, with the control running second. And then I predicted that the recipients of the negative message would be more likely to commit themselves to give money for the expenses of the revival than from those attending from other groups. And this was rejected too. The highly significant differences in the analysis of frequencies gave the control group the lead, with the mixed and negative messages persons running a close second and third, with the positive message coming in far behind. Actually, this is the only one, I should qualify myself, what I said a while ago, where they came in behind. As far as the commitments were concerned, in every case, well, the control group came in first, in all but one, and the mixed message group came in first on one instance and came in second on the other instance. So from a statistical point of view, both the positive and the negative messages were ruled out. Now, I don't have time to go into the post-test because I did a follow-up questionnaire that was analyzed by a computer of over 200 people in that sample to find out what kind of people these were in the various group. And all of that was, I think, was very interesting. Basically, though, in summation, what we found out, just taking that one situation, you know, at that one time with this one group of people, and that doesn't mean that, you know, it can be transferred, but at least it gives us some suggestions that it might work somewhere else. And by the way, to my knowledge, this is the first study of this type. I don't think there's ever been a study done. And so far, this was my, the first doctoral dissertation under Dr. Haskins. There had been some masters, but there had never been a doctoral dissertation to study that had been done. But basically what it showed was that the positive message that good news attracts people, or at least it brings people, it encourages people to bring guests to hear the good news for themselves, and that mixed news, and if you say that the control group became a mixed news group after being exposed to the mixed message of the evangelist of the report, you could say that good news does not will maybe have some initial attraction, but it won't motivate people to make convictions, commitments. Bad news is a kind of a turnoff. And people are more actually to make commitments, at least in this type of situation, to a message of hope, where they see that the situation is bad, but there is hope. Now, I think personally that is the not only this world reality, but it's also biblical reality. I think that's very well stated in Romans 6:23. The wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life through Jesus Christ our Lord. There is the bad news, the wages of sin is death, and there is the silver lining. The gift of God is eternal life through Jesus Christ our Lord. I think there are some implications for this. I mentioned that it's, to my knowledge, the first empirical study on record comparing the effects of positive, negative, and mixed messages in a mass medium. It should, I would hope, encourage similar message effect studies in other mass media and subject fields, in political campaigns, for example, other populations, other locales. It should especially spike the interest of direct mail solicitors and print and broadcast news media competing for rating and readers. Haskins, as I mentioned before, found constructive treatment of bad news with hope to be more interesting to consumers than bad news by itself. Very small study. It may be that the reporting of bad news without hope may be unrealistic and unprofitable and even irresponsible in view of the human condition. Okay, I skipped an awful lot. I did not talk about communications effect. In the little handout that I have there, which was a kind of an afterthought, I'm just... You can throw away the resume or whatever you want to, the Vita. It just happened to be there, and it's some lectures that I give on the mass media, but there's one paragraph there that you might be interested in showing the history of communication effects. And this dissertation dealt with communication effects. And basically the history, as you'll see on there, the communication effects is that we start out in the 30s thinking the mass media had great power just to zap an audience over, and then the sociologists and the psychologists came to the conclusion that mass media did not have great effects, that audiences had strong wills to resist. But over the period of time, we have generally come back in the communications research field to a stronger effect. And to my belief, the best explanation of the strong effect of our commercial mass media today is ubiquity, number one, and that's expressed by Dr. E. Noel Newman, a German researcher. Ubiquity, the mass media is everywhere. Pervasive, ubiquity. Second is consonant. There have been studies shown that the movers and shakers in the mass media, as well as the entertainment world, hold a similar value system, which is over to the left and out of sync with mainstream values. You might have guessed that already, but it's been pretty well established. Ubiquity, consonance, and then cumulation, one message after another. Now, the problem with measuring that is, of course, it takes longitudinal studies. And as you know, longitudinal studies are a lot more difficult to do and take a lot more time than something that you can do in just a matter of days. And even though you can, as my study was carefully controlled to show cause and effect. But even there, it's very limited. Okay, we've got a...
Excuse me, Jim, let me, I've got to get some information first. Is Carl Drick over here?
Let me tell you what we're going to do. There's a third paper by Henry Ayub, who apparently couldn't come. He's going to talk on the Lady of Zaytun, which sounds intriguing if you read the abstract.
Oh, my.
And my understanding was that his associate, Carl Jericho, who I think had been here yesterday, was going to give the paper for him, but nobody knows what's going on. So let me declare now, officially, that we'll dispense with the third paper, unless Carl comes in somewhere along the line. And that will give the two of you the full hour and a half. Okay? Now let me divide it up this way. Supposing you go until about 20 of Jim.
All right.
Give you,
okay, 15 minutes for discussion.
We'll give you 40 minutes, Jim, John.
Okay.
And then we'll have 10 minutes at the end for discussion of both papers. Fair enough?
All right, do you want me to go ahead some more with my paper or to have discussion now? I'd just as soon have discussion.
Okay. Questions, and let's go then until 20 up.
Okay. This is just a segment of a dissertation, and so there's a lot more in there. Let me.
Jim, I had a question.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm probably going to talk about this negative news, and it is so negative that they're afraid of going outdoors, they're afraid of people, and they're afraid of a number of these things. How do you think that relates to this idea of the message of culture? It seems to be related very much to this negative news. They're almost glued to their sets every night.
Well,
there's a group of people to whom we are about when we're hearing this.
There's a huge argument today going as to, does the media really affect people, especially media violence? And I've talked to people in the media, and they tend to be very defensive about this. And I remember talking with a manager of a television station in El Paso, Texas, one time. We had a discussion about this in his office. And he said, we do not cause effects in society. We simply follow society. Now, what we do know about the effects of, for example, television now, we do know that certain types of people tend to be heavy television watchers. They tend to be passive, and that these people tend to have more problems. Now, we also know that there's a lot of correlational evidence. You know, you read about this all of the time, but, you know, showing that somebody watched something or another, and then they went out and did it. They went out and raped a woman, you know, just like that. And, of course, I know we're moving over into entertainment, but the way the news is going today, particularly in the networks, there's a very hard line. I mean, I don't say a hard line. It's hard to
distinguish.
It really is. And, you know, the big rhubarb going on now with CBS News. They're taking their news off, and they're going to an entertainment format. And most people today get their news by television. That was one of the studies, by the way, on our follow-up on the questionnaire, what's your main source of news? There are lots of correlations, but there are very few real good studies that show causality. And that's the problem that the Meese Report is having right now. And so people argue. Now, you know, there were some studies done by three presidential commissions on linking possible TV and violence and pornography and that sort of thing. The problem was many of the scholars withdrew from those presidential commissions after they found that the networks had control over the evaluation process. That, to me, was the scandal, and they never were. A lot of people, a lot of the researchers in the field just simply said it's a stacked deck. And it's a difficult field. And it's a difficult study.
I'm asking not just going out and doing violence, but people who become afraid to go out because they think there's so much violence out there. In other words, they're getting their news from TV. They're getting all this bad news to the point they're afraid to even go out on the street at certain times because they're afraid somebody's
Yes,
going to attack
there is a paper written by a man at Georgia, and I don't recall his name, but I have his paper here. In fact, he gave it at a seminar at the University of Tennessee after I did my dissertation, in which he says that's very true, that there are some people like that. Now, a steady diet of bad news doesn't seem, apparently, the media doesn't seem to have that much effect upon what might be called healthy personalities. But I come back to effects to what Noelle Newman, the woman, said in Germany. Ubiquity, consonance, and accumulation. And I do lectures on the mass media, and that little handout there, three or four of those lectures, I have a sort of a paragraph in which I talk about the value systems of the mass media and some of the effects and the challenge to Christians in the mass media. One of the things, I went back when I was 49 to study for a PhD, which is a story in itself. And when it came time, when I, you know, they put the hood over your neck, while my kids just yelled, "I have three daughters," and my wife turned to the woman next to her and said, "If you think they're loud, you should hear the grandchildren." So I learned a lot. I've been interested in the media, been a writer for years and years, but I really learned a lot in effect, and I was interested, you know, in communication effects, how the mass media works, the sociological system, and I don't think we've done enough as Christians to consider the system of mass media. The man from Hope College, you remember, he talked about how psychology, the psychologists had pretty much put Freud down the drain. Well, most Americans remember him because of the mass media. He's still a good mass. He still sells. He still sells. And what may be true in a discipline among people there, it may not necessarily be true across the country. And the mass media, I think, has something to do with that. Okay, I'll stop. And by the way, you folks who came in, one of the sessions will not make it tonight. So John and I over here, you are going to be victimized by us. He's going to come on in about 9 minutes. And then he will have an hour and a half. So that's why I'm going long. Okay, somebody else or some comment. Yes, ma'am.
Just a comment on, you mentioned the similar value system of the media and just kind of how insidious it is. About 3 weeks ago, there was a show called After the Sexual Revolution. I don't know what channel it was.
I saw part of it.
And yeah, they would make, you know, as psychologists, you know, you have controlled studies and you're very careful about the kind of overall statements you make about societal trends, but they'll just come out and say the American family as we knew it is dead and go on. Well, you know, that might be true in certain large cities.
That's correct.
But they'll just kind of tell you this, and you know, it's like, you know, Meyer said, you know, either you change your lifestyle to follow that, or you know, you have this attitude and behavior that, you know, you've got to reject what they say or change. So it puts you in a state of dissonance when you hear these statements coming at you about the way,
yes,
you know,
it does.
America is, and it's, without any qualifications at all.
Well, the studies that was done by some men at George Washington University, first of all, they looked at the movers and shakers in the news media, Time, Newsweek, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the networks, the movers and shakers, Dan and Tom and all these guys. And they found out that their value system was way to the left. The majority of them accepted adultery as okay. The great majority of them accepted homosexuality as morally neutral. The great majority said abortion was a woman's choice, was okay. 81% had voted for George McGovern, which I thought was interesting. And all sorts of things. Only 8% attended any kind of church or synagogue, you know, with any regularity at all. Then they made a second study of the entertainment people in Hollywood, the people in the film and entertainment industry. And they found substantially the same results as far as the value system. Then they made a third study of the graduate students at Columbia University School of Journalism. And they found substantially the same thing. And it is kind of pervasive in covering some stories. Well, my wife and I did a book on Jimmy Carter and his church, and we lived in the America's Motel for a while with the White House press corps. And so we ate breakfast and lunch and dinner and sat around and talked and everything else with the White House press corps. And these are all good people. But there's only one out of the White House press corps that would even admit to being a committed Christian. Now, Sam Donaldson has said he was a backslidden Southern Baptist, but I wouldn't count Sam, you know, in that group. But they all seem to be completely quite a bit different. And then another thing I noticed in the White House press corps, and I've never written a piece on this, but was that they sit around and ABC had asked CBS, "What do you think of this? How do you read this?" You know, and this sort of thing. That's kind of journalistic incest.
Yes, right.
And it is difficult with the mass media. Now, the mass media people, I only know one person in the television industry, really a top man, very well. And he admits to me that this is a problem. He admits to me, and this is Ron Powers, the media critic for with Charles Chabrol. And Ron is from Hannibal, Missouri. And Ron will always come on, "Here's your old friend from the Eastern liberal establishment, you know, Todd." And I said, "Yeah, I know you, man." And he says he enjoys getting back to out to Hannibal and away from the Eastern Seaboard. Now, most of these folks are concentrated in three areas, in New York and Washington and in Southern California. And a lot of times they cover news in areas where they have a station. There's all kinds of things that relate to why the mass media acts as it does, and
you know, from an operational standpoint, why they cover certain news. And there's just not enough studies been done. Living together, I think it'd be an interesting study. We all know that there are more couples living together outside of marriage than there ever was. But it has become almost a legitimate and a normal sort of thing. I don't remember study from the George Washington University people. They did study. Another interesting thing that they turned up in the study of the leaders in the entertainment industry, 50% of them are Jewish. I don't quite know how to explain that. I mean, there may be an explanation of it, you know. That the demographics on some of these things can be very, very interesting.
The article I read was talking about the need for more Christians to be scriptwriters, screenwriters, that kind of thing in Hollywood. I mean, it's just almost non-existent.
Go ahead.
I'm just thinking, in response to her comment, the problem is that too often in Christianity we have said that it's non-Christian. You're only a full-time Christian if you're a minister or a pastor. So it doesn't matter whether it's field of entertainment or scriptwriting or psychology or psychiatry for years, the attitude has been as wrong for Christians as doing anything else.
I have a feeling most of my writing, all the years, has been written within the what might be called the Christian ghetto, for good or bad. And I have a feeling that as Christians, we're still suffering from some of the old fundamentalist taboos, and we are just not willing to do. Now, the media, of course, it's an interesting thing. The owners of the media are not necessarily ideologically motivated. I mean, these are parts of conglomerates. The bottom line is the dollar, the ratings, what count. But now, many of the people in the media, and some will admit it, are ideologically motivated, although they say we try to be fair. I think all of this, at least to me, my study of the mass media, is a challenge for Christians to be more interested in the broader mass media. And if I can get in a commercial here before I stop. 2 years ago, I came over to Hannibal LaGrange College as writer in residence to start a writer's conference. And the big question came up, this Southern Baptist College, is, are we going to have a Christian writer's conference? And after my experience at the University of Tennessee, I said, no, I said, I don't think we want another Christian writer's conference. There are some good ones around the country. I said, let's have a general trade writer's conference in which Christians are involved. And so we've done that 2 years in a row. The second year, we've got a master's credit program set up with the university in Missouri. And so we invite people in who are not necessarily Christians, but we also have some Christians. And it's an interesting mix. We get some militant secularists, and we get some that are just out of Thomas Road Baptist Church, and put them in the same dormitory. And their discussions go on and on and on, and they'll go to midnight, and then they'll go down and have coffee. And there's some frustrations when you deal with a writer's conference with that. But that is one of the things we're trying to do at Hannibal, is to become, in other words, a little more a part of the system, to understand and see if we can't help people to write. And of course, we're talking about writing there, but the same thing would be true of television. And I don't have time for another commercial, because my wife's part at Hannibal LaGrange, she's the drama director, and both of us have some very strong concerns along this area. But we're just two small people in a little tiny puddle. And I don't know, if I had it all to do over again, I might take a different course in my life. I don't know. But you go from where you are.
Jim,
I think we've about time.
You'll get some more questions later on. Can you call Rick Oakham in? Okay.
Fine. I'm right at this middle level right here, where down here you see I can't, it's with the line where my glasses is, but that's all right. You should have in your hands a copy of a magazine article I did called Not Just Another Grim Story, that appeared in Family Life Today. And I reproduced this. It's on front and back side, because I think if I had to quickly tell you what I thought about fairy tales, it's there, the main thing I want to say, if you haven't thought much about it. And it's a good starter in thinking about that sort of thing. The bibliography is very partial, but it is, again, a starter if you want to think about fairy tales and the seriousness of them. Bruno Bettelheim has had a profound influence on my thinking.
and there's an annotated note there which I will not read from him in the bibliography. 10 years ago, I made a rather dramatic career change, which I will not go into. I had written children's science textbooks, and I found myself teaching children's literature, and I really enjoyed it, making a transition from science ed to English while still being active with science education. One of the reasons I really enjoyed this was because children's literature is a real minefield of issues. If you want to get involved in controversial discussion in a university setting with a lot of people with a lot of different values, children's literature is a great place to do it because everybody wants to capture children's minds. And I'll just make one comment that may prompt some questions later. I've been very much sort of on a personal crusade against censorship, which may perhaps would raise some eyebrows. I've been one to encouraging people to open the library doors and let's read things and let's learn about things. Because as Christians, we accept the truth, we believe in truth, and we don't have to be fearful about looking at other ideas. Now, that's not the same thing as wallowing in other ideas. But I think if we're going to be informed people and help people who are our peers and people who study under us, we need to be familiar with all sides of things. And you certainly can do this in children's literature. And at the same time, as when I talk about this sort of thing, I say, by the way, there is a Christian point of view as well. So if we're talking about where people come from, everybody comes from somewhere. I happen to be a Christian. And presuppositions, of course, affect how we think and how we act. So it's a great place for dialogue in the university. 4 years ago, I published Pillar of Pepper, and in the introduction here, there's two introductions. I seem to like to write those. It also has some more of my thinking about fairy tales and violence and that sort of thing. This was published by David C. Cook 4 years ago, and I should mention here that, to my delight, it's going to be reviewed in the Children's Literature Association Quarterly in the summer issue. In fact, it may be out now, but my mail hasn't caught up with me yet, and that's a secular magazine that's all of a sudden, it's a secular journal that's taking a new look at Christian children's literature, and Pillar of Pepper will be featured in that. 3 years ago, I began a very exciting journey with my daughter, who was then 7. Phoebe and I began reading through the complete Grimm's fairy tales. All 830 pages of the volume we had, 212 stories. And I became very fascinated with the old classic fairy tale and the power that these stories had. And power, I believe, for good. And that's spelled out in the sheet which you have there. And I won't go into all of that because I wouldn't know exactly when to stop. But I became convinced that fairy tales help us do certain things that science cannot. And I think the more we understand about science, the more we realize it's very effective when it's operating within its sphere. When it gets out of its sphere, problems begin to happen. And there are many things which are very important to us, many ideas, things that we feel, if I may use that terminology, that are important, that we can't really test with science. But we can test them in other ways. And I think fairy tales are a good way to do that, and incidentally, this is in keeping with much of what Bettelheim and others say. So if you look on this sheet, I list here 10 things that I believe that fairy tales can test in our thinking. Not giving us hard-nosed data, but ideas that can be tested and explored, which incidentally run counter to many of the humanistic values that are assumed and taught either directly or indirectly today. The first is that some important and real things exist in the world that are mysterious and presently beyond explanation. Secondly, there is a meaning and pattern to much that we do not understand in life, as well as a meaning and pattern to that which we do understand. Third, evil is real and terrible and is present in the world. Four, good is real and wonderful, and is also present in the world. If one accepts good in the proper way, one can overcome evil. Five, both good and evil behavior, whether mysterious or ordinary, have consequences. 6. The solving of problems in the right way leads to happy endings. 7. The right way to solve a problem may not always be obvious at first. 8. Strong and marvelous powers may be tapped in helping people do either good or evil. 9. At times, a person must accept and submit to things he doesn't fully understand in order to succeed. 10. The unlikely person, the weak, the gentle, the young, the simple, or the unlearned, can succeed, even become a hero, if he does the right things in the right way. Now, these are 10 things that I thought about a lot and emerged as I began to look at fairy tales. And I think these are things that are continually tested over and over again in the stories. And they're also things which are very important for us to consider as human beings. And what I would like to do with the balance of my time presenting, I hope some questions will arise later, is to read an original fairy tale that I have written and that I think illustrates, by way of example, these 10 things which are listed on the sheet. And I believe it's in keeping with many of the structures and stereotypes and folk motifs of Grimm's classic folklore, as well as you'll see some echoes, perhaps, of Pilgrim's Progress in it as well, which is a very, I think, interesting story to talk about. The name of this story is The Man and the Scarlet Cloak. And since this is being taped, I will mention that it is a copyrighted story. So, here is a fairy tale, a new fairy tale, presumably an old tradition that incorporates some of the old devices of classic stories. The Man and the Scarlet Cloak. Once long ago, there was a small kingdom that had a high wall around it. It was ruled by a good king and queen with 7 sons who were quite different from one another. The oldest of the 7 was much more royal than his brothers, and he loved the ways of palace life. The 2nd son knew the most because he spent time reading scrolls and parchments in the royal archives, which was the library of that day. The 3rd son was the bravest and the best fighter. The 4th son was the most handsome. The 5th was the fastest and could run like the wind. The 6th son could figure things out. He was the cleverest. The 7th son, however, was simply simple. He did nothing well and was the most ordinary of the 7. Also, he was by far the youngest. Consequently, his brothers looked upon him as just a boy and had little to do with him. And I'll stop just for a moment. If you people on the outside want to come in, you're welcome to come in. When the sons grew older, their mother, the beloved queen, grew sick and died, even though she was not very old. The king was greatly saddened by this, and unfortunately, as he grew older, his goodness left him. He became wicked, and more wicked, and all his kingdom with him. Soon, lying, cheating, thievery, drunkenness, and murder became so common that many terrible four-legged creatures that enjoy evil heard about this and made their way to the kingdom. They made their homes just outside the wall. Then, since no one could safely go in and out of the gates of the kingdom, the land outside became known as the Plain of Death. So the city and countryside within the walled kingdom became separated from the vast lands beyond it. One of the places outside the wall looked like another kingdom with a wall around it. It was mysterious and lay distant on the horizon. Some said that the kingdom was a green-hilled paradise, but most doubted this. After years of wicked living, hardly anyone within the king's city believed that anything of importance existed beyond their wall. Finally, as the king lay dying, he saw how foolish he had been. Consequently, in tears, he confessed his wickedness and repented for all the wrong he had done. But the royal court did not agree. They were embarrassed by the king's change of heart and had no desire to give up their evil ways. Nonetheless, the king called together his seven sons. He begged their forgiveness, blessed each one, asked them to look after one another, and gave each son a bag of gold. While the sons wondered who he would choose to sit next on the throne, the king told of a vision he had had the night before. Within 7 days, all that is within this kingdom will be destroyed, he said. Even though I have repented and have peace in my heart, I must die with my kingdom. But you, my sons, can still be spared. If you wish to live, you must do exactly as I say. First, leave this city and kingdom at once. Second, seek out the sage of Salem. He is the only one who is truly wise. When you find him, give him your gold, hear his words, and do what he says. For he knows what is going on and has walked this way before. Listen to no one else, for if you do, you will lose everything, even your lives. With those words, the king lay back on his bed and died. Then, even before anyone had time to cry, the oldest son, who was the most royal one, declared that he could not believe the strange words of his father, so regardless of what his brothers did, he would remain, give his father a proper burial, and sit on the throne in his place. The royal court was greatly relieved by these words, and the oldest son at once became the new king. So it fell to the second son, who had learned the most, to see that he and his other brothers obeyed their father's final wish. Sadly, this son turned his back upon his parchments and scrolls, and with many questions which he kept to himself, he immediately led his five younger brothers in their royal clothes out of the palace. Those who believed in the sage of Salem said that if he could be found, it would probably be far from the city and somewhere near the wall of the kingdom. So the brothers headed that way, ignoring the laughing and teasing of those who watched them pass through the city streets. But before they had quite put the city behind them, they met a candle maker who asked who they were and what they were about. "We are sons of the king, and we seek the sage of Salem," declared the second son. "You must be joking," said the candle maker, amused by such an answer from a man in royal clothes. At this, the son who had learned much rolled his eyes up toward the sky. He mumbled to himself, "Me? Joking? But you know, I haven't really thought about this. Maybe I'm making a fool of myself." Then he thanked the candle maker for being so honest and helpful. Turning to his brothers, he said that, regardless of what they did, he must return home and see what his parchments and scrolls said about all this. Before his brothers knew what was happening, the second son was on his way back to the palace. So it fell to the third son, the bravest one, who wore shining armor in readiness for battle, to lead his brothers as they continued. As they left the city, the remaining sons began to argue, except for the youngest, who did not know enough to argue, about who this sage might be and what they should do if they found him. Some said that he was hundreds, even thousands of years old. Others that he was without beginning and without end. Still others that he was a king of a forgotten kingdom or a priest of the Most High. But most people laughed and said that he was only a creature who lived in the minds of those who chose to believe in such things. Since they wanted to use well the time that they had left, the sons decided to split up and scour the countryside in search of the old man from Salem. At noon on the sixth day, without any success whatever, the third oldest had had enough. He was tired of the amused faces of those he had asked about the sage. So regardless of what his brothers would choose to do, he decided he would ignore his father's words and cross the plain of death on his own. So he tightened his armor, proudly drew his sword, and opening one of the rusty gates in the wall, he left his father's kingdom. At first, he was startled by a foul odor that stung his nostrils, but then he saw in the distance what seemed to be a lush green hills that rose above a long white ribbon that might be the wall of another kingdom. But before he had taken a dozen steps into the bright sunlight, a roaring lion with red claws, a bear twice normal size, a purplish green dragon breathing smoke, and a scaly snake-like creature with stumpy legs and horrible teeth were upon him. For several seconds, the bravest son's sharp sword flashed in the sunlight, but he was no match for such enemies and was quickly killed within a stone's throw from the wall. Soon afterward, the fourth son, the most handsome one, came across a clearing within a clump of trees close to the wall. In it, he noticed an old man preparing a simple meal over a small fire. The man's hands moved slowly as he worked. His hair was long, both it and his beard were snow white. And oddly, he wore a full-length hooded cloak of simple homespun that was a bright scarlet. Before the handsome son had time to realize how hungry he was, the man looked up with kind eyes and asked him to sit down and share his food. After the son had eaten his fill, he asked, as he had asked so many, if he knew of the sage of Salem and how he might be reached. "He can only be reached with the hands of the heart," declared the man in the scarlet cloak. "If only I had such hands," said the son. He looked at his own handsome fingers with their carefully cut nails. "If you speak sincerely, use the hands you have," said the sage of Salem, for that was who the old man was. He extended his rough hand to the fourth son, who received it with his soft fingers. Then the son shared for all his father had told him, except about the gold. A plain man would have little use for so much money, he thought. The sage explained that there was only one way to pass safely through the plain of death. A person must wear the scarlet cloak that he himself wore. The son stared in disbelief, but he accepted the cloak which the man offered, laying it lightly across his arm so as not to wrinkle his rich velvet tunic. It was a brilliant garment of coarse weave, but soft, as light as goose down, and it had a wonderful smell that seemed a mix of cedar and some spring flower he couldn't remember the name of. But the cloak looked so different that it embarrassed him. If he wore it, everyone would notice, even from far away. Politely, he thanked the old man, bade him goodbye, and left with the cloak, not sure what he would do next. While he thought about this, as he walked beside the wall, the fourth son saw someone approaching. As the person came closer, he beheld a beautiful maiden perfectly clothed in gold and silk. Her walk came as a gentle wave, and her feet hardly seemed to touch the ground. For a moment, he was disturbed by the girl's eyes, which were not brown, not blue, not even green, but with the color of polished bronze. When he was close enough to see her smile, his cheeks flushed nearly the color of his cloak. When at last the girl stood before him, she looked puzzled and asked what the cloak was. Before he realized it, the son told her about the old man and all that had happened. The girl threw back her head and laughed. "Oh, him," she said. "And you believed him?" Then the sun felt her eyes upon his handsome body. "If you really want to cross the plain of death, let me take you. I have been this way before, and I can show you how it's done." Since she spoke boldly, the handsome son decided, regardless of what his brothers might do, to leave at once. He tossed aside the scarlet cloak so the maiden could take his arm, and together they left. But as soon as they stepped through a gate in the wall, the son was so sickened by the smell of the plain of death that he tried to turn back. The maiden's gentle touch, however, suddenly changed into a vice-like grip. When he turned again into the bronze eyes, of his companion, he found himself staring into the face of an ugly witch. The fourth son tried to flee, but was powerless to escape her grasp, and so he was lost forever outside the kingdom. Only moments afterward, the fifth son, who was the fastest runner, came upon the old man again preparing a meal, and again wearing a scarlet cloak. The man shared his food as before, and the son ate heartily. Likewise, after exchanging similar words with the old man, the son courteously left with the cloak, which he threw about his shoulders without fastening any of the buttons. As the fastest son walked away, pondering the sage's words, he approached a gate in the wall. Here he stopped, and despite its rusted hinges, he pulled it open just to find out what was on the other side. In the afternoon light, he saw far away the same white wall and green hills that his brother had seen earlier. In the plain before him, he could also see far away several of the animals that his brother had faced. The fifth son, however, ignored the foul odor. He thought that these animals did not seem too frightening. They, like other wild creatures, were probably afraid of people in daylight. Also, since they seemed busy about their own business, he thought that he could just walk across the plain, avoiding any trouble. If necessary, he could run part of the distance to the white wall. Since his new cloak would get in the way if he had to hurry, he laid it aside. He also laid aside any concern for how his brothers might cross the plain. With faith in his fast feet, off he went. But no sooner had he taken a dozen steps than the gate slammed behind him with a bang. The creatures turned his way, and the son immediately had to flee. In seconds, the animals were upon him, and so the fastest son also died within only yards of his father's kingdom. In the late afternoon, the sixth son, who was the cleverest of the brothers, was next to stumble upon the old man. He had the same kind of meal and conversation, and soon left with the unusual cloak, which he fastened with a single button about his neck. Since he, more than the others, knew that it was not easy to start living in a new place, he also said nothing about his gold. When the clever son left, he thought the hardest of all about what to do. Though the red coat fit perfectly from head to toe, it was a poor disguise on the open plain. It would attract more, not less, attention than what he already had on. But as he pondered this, he got an idea. Quickly, he took the cloak off and used it as a model to cut out and sew together another garment using pieces of tent cloth and other clothing from his bag. Though he made his cloak exactly the same size and shape as the one he had been given, he made it the color of the plain. As the son was so clever, he finished his skillful work in hardly any time at all. His brothers would have been amazed. Then the sixth son laid aside the cloak he had been given and put on the one he had made. He buttoned it up and it fit perfectly. Then, completely forgetting his less skillful brothers, he set out through a gate in the wall. For a while, all went well. But as the sun began to sink, the colors of the plain changed and did not blend in so well with the cloak he had made. Also, the sun's smell was different from that of the plain. The evil eyes and nostrils at last discovered these differences, and the creatures were greatly angered. In a short time, they found the cleverest son, and he also gave up his life. While evening was still gray, the seventh and youngest son also found the man in the scarlet cloak, and after eating, asked him if he knew the whereabouts of the sage of Salem. The man extended his hand, and the son, though only a boy, looked into the man's kind eyes. He knew at once that he had found the one he was looking for. Reaching into his belt, he produced the bag of gold and gave it all to the sage. As the old man took his gift, the earth trembled, cracks appeared in the wall, and the gates of the kingdom sprang open of their own accord. "Take this cloak, put it on, and start out at once without looking back," he said. When the son asked about his brothers, he was told that each one had already passed that way, that each had thought only of himself, and that each, in his own manner, had already set out across the plain. Now he, though just a boy, had to do the same as the kingdom was at its end. Then the sage turned, and as he walked away, he disappeared from sight. The youngest son was alone. He put on the scarlet cloak, buttoned it up from bottom to top, and pulled up the hood. He was surprised at how perfectly the cloak covered him. Slowly he made his way to an open gate and edged his way out onto the plain. To his horror, the sun had already set. Evil-looking creatures began appearing from nowhere, on all sides, all kinds of them, many more than his brothers had faced. And as the sky darkened, still more appeared, awakened, as it were, by the night. Even worse, the ground trembled again. Lightning cut the sky, and a great fireball flashed over his head and down upon the kingdom he had left. Then there was an explosion that nearly knocked him off his feet. Yet he dared not look back or even glance from side to side. He was scared, so he simply moved ahead as he was told. As he did, the cedary smell of the cloak so overpowered the bad odor of the plain that he hardly noticed it. The youngest son knew that his old world had come to an end, yet he was still alive. But so were the creatures on the plain. They seemed hungry and eager to enter the gates of his father's kingdom and devour what was left inside. The boy on the plain stood in the way of many of them, and all the creatures, of course, could see him from far off. Consequently, they moved toward the youngest son from all sides, in pairs or threes. Yet the son refused to try to hide or even run to right or left, or stop, or even slow down his pace. Although he could hear paws and hooves tearing the ground as the creatures approached him, the son did not look at them. Instead, he kept his feet and eyes riveted straight ahead toward the wall that grew larger and the green-hilled kingdom that rose above it in the distance. Before him, the kingdom, it seemed, was bathed in its own light that rose from the darkness. The youngest son closed his eyes time after time and gritted his teeth as one creature after another sprang towards him. But oddly, each one, even those 2 and 3 times larger than the son, stopped short and growled or snarled before jumping away when its eyes fixed upon the cloak. The son was not touched by a single tooth or claw or hoof, though many came close. It was as if the cloak had passed that way before, and none had courage enough to face the one who wore it. Finally, the last and largest of the evil creatures, who had glowing eyes and fire spewing from its nostrils, approached with a great roar. But when it saw the scarlet cloak and the one who wore it, and that the one who wore it proceeded straight ahead without fear, it also turned and bounded away to catch up with the last creatures entering the ruined kingdom. Then the bad smell disappeared, and nothing further stood in the way of the youngest son. Soon he could make out details of the mysterious kingdom before him. Light from somewhere behind the walls brightened the night sky overhead as if it were day, but the brightness was only inside. Beyond the wall, the sun could see the leaves of trees rustling on a tall hill. Suddenly his heart leaped, for standing on that hill beneath a dazzling light, he could see the sage of Salem himself. And several people stood with him, looking in the boy's direction. There was, and the son rubbed his eyes, his father, the king, and yes, even his beloved mother, the queen. His mother appeared more beautiful than he had remembered. The son was overwhelmed with joy. The magnificent wall around this kingdom was unbroken and white. It had a silver gate. When he reached it, it opened. He was surprised by the size and great beauty of the city that stood on the rolling hills inside. Then he was welcomed by a messenger of the sage, who took his scarlet cloak and gave him a soft robe of purest white. And so the youngest son entered another kingdom, where he lived in happiness and peace.
Thank you, John, for a charming story and a pointed message. If we have some time, we'll see if we can get some discussion. But our third presenter is here, at least his associate, Carl Green.